to eat his chicken. And we'll only be up here in time for him to get back and have dessert, but this is a great moment for me, at least, to have a chance to, for once in my life, actually ask him questions. We all know Jack Butler. He's been one of the pillars of our community for many, many years. He's been responsible for many of our innovations and certainly has always upheld the highest standards of our profession in the face of what has always been, I would say, a challenging environment. He's had a very distinguished career, as all you probably know. And rather than ask him questions and let him respond, I'm going to ask him only four questions, get them all up front, and then he can just talk as long as he wants. And as much as he wants.
Can you do one at a time?
No, because that would be too easy. But I do want to allow you to tell us a bit about what lessons you've learned from your career that have brought you to this moment, the things that you're most proud of, and, you know, most importantly, what lessons you can offer the younger people in the room about your career, why you chose to do this, why you still think it's important, and what you see is the future of our profession. And lastly, last question is, what do you see happening over the next year or two in terms of the next set of opportunities and what all the political changes around us mean for the restructuring community? So with that, Jack Butler.
Thanks, Ken. Let me, I don't know which one. I'm not quite sure where you start.
You can start anywhere you like. You're
with all those questions, but
I want you to know before you start. You met for the first time back in 2002 when we were both advising Kmart Corporation, and Jack Butler astonished us as the banker to the company by coming in literally on the first day and saying, "Okay, I'm going to have the confirmation hearing on this date, this Thursday hearing on this date, and we're going to have the confirmation order done by this date." And amazingly enough, he hit every single date.
Well, that, you know, but that actually, if you want to talk about lessons learned,
yeah.
I mean, you know, I learned that lesson from some other people, so I'll sort of say to you that, you know, in the business we're in, by the way, I think this is true, whether it's regular way M&A or I think it's really important that you have a sense of your exit before you get involved, if it's possible. And sometimes things are involuntary, right? Things occur, you get a phone call, and it's already fully committed, and you need to actually step in. But I do think it's important that, if you can, that you try to chart a course. And, you know, those of you who know me well, and there are a number of people in the room who know me well, you know, can chuckle about that because they've seen a number of charts and courses that have altered during the course of a particular transaction. And so that really fancy chart that we show in day one doesn't look quite the same on day 50 or day 100 or, in the case of the automotive restructuring business, 4 years later, right? Well, we restructured the industry times to get through what's changed in the world. So I think I would start with the, I think, Ken, with that, which is when you get involved in something, have a sense of how you're going to get out of it. An awful lot of people don't have that sense, don't plan for that, don't think about exits. What's for sure, and we've all experienced it, is very few things are a straight line. Very few things are going to go exactly the way you plan them. But if you have a point of view of where you're going to end up, it's kind of like sailing, right? And so you may have to tack left or tack right. You know, you may get into a squall. You may get into a full-blown gale. You actually may actually occasionally, you know, lose the mast and, you know, call for a replacement mast and whatever you have to do. But it's actually, if you have a sense of where you're going to end up, you can navigate much more successfully than if you're willing to be buffeted by whatever the particular point of view is, right? Because in the world we would sort of, and remember, I started in an industry, I started at a time, Ken and I grew up about 3 miles from each other, with another guy named Jay Alex, who grew up a couple miles from there. And Jay was an accountant, right? And he wasn't an investment banker. And, you know, and I was a regional lawyer at a law firm. And I lasted 18 months at my first law firm and got fired, right, because I wasn't a conventional first-year associate. One of the things I would say to younger people, and I tell that story, and I tell it fairly proudly, and actually a very close friend of mine is the CEO of that law firm now. We started as summer associates. He ended up being CEO of the firm. I ended up getting booted after 18 months because there wasn't a fit between what they wanted at that moment in time and what I was interested in actually doing. And I think, and there's no shame in that. And I think it's important actually to say to everybody, and I think frankly even those of us who are more senior can look at the same thing, there's no shame in actually having enough self-awareness to figure out that, you know, this a particular fit doesn't work. And it can work because not work because of chemistry, it can not work because you don't have the right mentor, it can not work because you have a lot more to offer than the position that has been created for you, which has a little box and you may be a big box, and you know, you don't fit into that particular hole. You know, there are too many people, frankly, in the business world who try to stay too long at the same place and at the same thing, figuring out that they can actually do something that they weren't meant to be. And one of the things I've, over the years, had a lot of pride in, you say one of the things I enjoyed doing, Ken, a lot, I take a lot of pride in, I've done a lot of mentoring over the years. I'm very proud of where I see the people who I've worked with over the years, where they are now, what they're doing now. And life comes full circle. In the merchant bank I launched recently, a number of those folks have come back in ways that have been extremely helpful to me in the worlds they live in now, where they're running funds and they're running businesses or they're doing whatever. So I do think it's important to you know, in your personal life, in your personal your business life, to sort of sort out where you need to be. But I started out back early on in a place where I didn't last. I found a place early on where I thought I would be, and I was a third-year associate. Now think about this: third-year associate, third-year, you know, an analyst or a associate in investment bank, you know, walking in, or whatever young person might be walking into your firm, you know, into your office as a more senior person, and they say, "Hey, I have a different business plan than you were thinking about. I think we could go do really well if we went and did X, Y, and Z, and I want to go do that, and will you let me go do it?" Right? So by a raise of hands, how many people in this room would let their third year whomever translate that to your own personal business when they come in with their own set of business objectives and they tell you that they'd like to go do something, and by the way, they want to go to a different city to actually get it done, right? And they'll come back and they'll report to you on it. How many of you would let them do that by show of hands? Okay, maybe one because he's sitting next to me, right?
Well, I agree
right,
with you.
Right? I mean, people, right? And yet, the second firm I was at let me do that, right? I said to them, I was a Detroiter, and I said I wanted to go to Chicago, which had a bigger market. I wanted to go actually reach out to some people who I knew through relationships, right? Contacts. This is before CRMs and automation and iPhones and all the kinds of ways of keeping track with people, but I did know a few people. And I wanted to actually go and have lunch with them and see if I could turn something up. Now, one of them happened to be the CEO of a big financial institution, and he happened to be 25. And we went and had lunch, and I did another important lesson, is I actually went to him, we had lunch, and I said to him, "Hey, Dan, I told my bosses back in Detroit that I was coming looking for business, like you're my best shot, can you give me some business?" Right? Which is another important lesson, right? Which is make the ask, right? Lots of people in life won't make the ask. In the new business context, in the deal negotiation context, in whatever context you want to put, make the ask. He actually, the guy who I made the ask to, the general counsel, said, not telling you what to do, but I want you to meet with this guy, and I would appreciate it if you find something for him to do. That something turned into 125 deals for me over that were involved, and those deals involved not just domestic deals, but deals on every continent other than Antarctica. And I was going around, and by the way, so I'm now 29, 30, right? And I've got 50 people working for me, and we're going all over. And we hire all of the big law firms and big investment banks as people to assist us, right? And what was that? What did that kid look like? And you'll say, I look the same guy now, right? But I'll say, what did that kid look like? That guy was arrogant, way, way too hard charging, not paying much attention to people, and didn't really listen very well.
Mellowed out.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's mellowed, but I will tell you what I think I have done, right? I mean, you don't change your basic stripes. My personality is my personality. And I am going to be outgoing and gregarious, and I'm going to push people and all those things. I think those people who know me well and those who are friends, including a number of you who are here today, will tell you that, you know, what I have done over a 30-plus year business is I listen really pretty well. So while I'm pushing, I'm actually listening pretty carefully. And it's not uncommon for me to come back to someone, and people are surprised I'll come back one day, 2 days, 3 days later. So, you know, about that thing you were talking about, you know, maybe we should do this as opposed to that. And there's like, you actually heard me say that? It's like, yeah, because I think another restructuring, right? You have to have the art of listening. You get in very big trouble if you don't pay attention to what other people want or need. You know, it doesn't mean you're going to give it to them. It doesn't mean you can deliver what they want. But it's a lot easier, right, to do a restructuring or a transaction or to do even a regular way deal. You're able to get everybody around the table what they want or some semblance, as opposed to more.
So now on that point, we all recognize great practitioners. Could have done anything. Why did you choose to spend your life dealing with crook companies? Neither one of which is easy.
No clue. No, I mean, and seriously, I didn't. You know, I never took a bankruptcy finance class in any form of higher education, business law, any of that stuff. Never took it. Never had really an interest in it, and it came from, I think, a sense of entrepreneurship. I happen to be, and I think this is, you know, and I've described myself in other settings as an outlier. And I think one of the elements of outliers is people who are outliers in their lives tend to have a certain self-awareness and tend to take advantage of opportunities that they see, tend to be on. And by the way, timing has to be right. You know, serendipity and luck, you know, are partly self-made, but they're also a product of the moment in time you grow up in, the moment in time you're there, right? I happened to come out of my education schooling at around the time the bankruptcy code had just been passed. And when I was looking around and surveying what I ought to do, what struck me was, oh my gosh, here's this brand new law. It does two things. It keeps state law fiduciaries in control of their businesses, pays market wages to advisors, which the prior laws didn't do either of those things. They took companies away, and they had this concept of economy, the sense of economy, so the idea that everything was discounted non-economic. Well, you know, Ken, when you're in a situation where all of a sudden you sort of say, okay, here's a brand new playing field, right? And if traditional corporate governance actually rules the day. So all the relationships you can maintain with independent directors, you know, and CEO, C-suites, and all those things actually make a difference and have value. And you actually can make an earning, a living wage at it. You know, it's not a sense of having a discount. You can actually make, in some contexts, premiums. Oh, that seemed to be pretty. And the other thing I thought was, you know, I'm 25, 26, and I think if I can figure this out really well, that people for a long time won't have that much of a step up. Part of that's, again, so part of that's a sense of arrogance. You could also say part of it's a sense of confidence. There's a belief that you could actually make a difference very early on by mastering something that people understand.
Housing distress. Exotic, strange world, a strange asset class. What lies ahead of us happening in our profession? What do you see happening in the world? Accelerate or make what we do.
Well, it's funny. Harvey and I were talking about this earlier today. That's what I said. Which I think is another mistake I think people make. Because I hear people in our business saying, okay, when is the next downturn? Let's run it out of a place where, you know, I want it to be terrible, right? My experience, if I look at all the economic cycles I've participated in, and correlated that to money made, value of transactions generated, I would tell you that by far, the most money's been made and the most bit transactions have been generated in upper scale as the curve, not as the curve is going. And you say, well, that can't be. Why is that? Well, it's for a really simple reason, right? Because there are exits. Because there's capital. Because people are actually willing to invest. right? And so if you find something that has to change and there's a change of control transaction, you've actually got people, maybe even people who want to compete for the change in control. And therefore you can create value, assuming you can solve all the other issues. And so when I look ahead, I happen to think, even though we're in our eighth or ninth year, I still believe that we have better days ahead in terms of, I believe, so I think there will be opportunities for exits. I think we're also at a place, and by the way, I think with the election, forgetting whatever your political perspective is, one thing we should all agree on is that there is far more uncertainty in what is going to happen over the next 18 to 20 months than there would have been under any other electoral outcome. And so I don't know what lies ahead, particularly President Trump and with Congress. What I do know is I think in my lifetime it's happened four times, miscount, but I think it's happened four times in my lifetime, where there has, in my electoral lifetime, there has been a party that's gotten completely, twice the Republicans had it, and twice the Democrats had it. And I think what everybody understands is it's a lot harder than it looks, right? And that when you have the ability to actually govern and or have the accountability to govern, it's not as easy to get things done. So like in healthcare, this, as I think people are already beginning to understand, it's, highly unlikely. Well, I think it's highly likely that in the first 6 months of next year, we will see a bill passed that has a sentence in it that says Obamacare is repealed. The next paragraph is going to say, on a schedule to be determined, right? And when we're done, what we're going to do is find out that be a healthcare system that will have changes in it. There was going to be a healthcare system that was going to have changes made in it. So I don't, so we won't call it Obamacare now. We'll call it something else. But it's. I think it's unlikely that the nation is going to disenfranchise 20 million people in healthcare. I think it's unlikely that all of us are going to lose the portability of healthcare and allows us, if we have pre-existing conditions, to go from one place to another and get an insurance, life insurance policy, and on and on and on. Well, that's true in lots of things that are, out there, it's trade or healthcare or other economic reform or Wall Street reform or giving power back to Wall Street. I think things are uncertain. How much is going to be able to be accomplished? I think we can all pretty much bet there will be less regulation rather than more. I don't know how that translates. So uncertainty generally generates complexity, and volatility generally means opportunity. Right? So I look at the, from a deal perspective, I think it's going to be, there's going to be lots of opportunities.
One last question before I... What is next for you? You led our profession 30-plus years. Every time you're not going to slow down and retire to Florida, I know. What do you get excited about?
The softball. I appreciate that.
We're finishing up. That's why
he knows what I'm doing. First of all, I have, as those of you know me, I have young kids. I have teens. Just being 15, so 4 kids to put through college. And so I stepped away a few years ago from law to get on the principal. A role that some of you would argue I had earlier, quasi sense at least. This year launched a merchant bank. And for me, merchant bank is sort of the culmination of the two, because it's the intersection of intellectual, which I find exciting. If I look at everything I did, and if I look at the 10 significant things, they have all had associated with them. And then the tenacity, the effort to actually execute on those. And that's what merchant banks do, right? They have big ideas. And so, I'm starting, as I again, building from whole cloth. process in the next consulting business that's not going to challenge its partners anyplace else. We're not trying to do that. In fact, you know, I have a perspective. It's auto partner. Investment banker is a board turnaround. So, you know, we have that side of the business, which is the intellectual side of the business. The fundraising mode, never easy to raise a lot of capital out. The fund closed. Now, every benchmark we've kind of set on whole life, we have charts and benchmarks.
You have a plan.
And benchmarks and charts, and fortunately, we're ahead of the mark on virtually everything. I know that won't stay that case, so you'll stumble here or there. But there is, I think, you know, look at some of the successful merchant banks out there and successful banks to come, right? I mean, someone left Credit Suisse in the last couple months and just announced that they're going to start a merchant bank. Dollars of fund. I don't have quite that much of a lead investor, but the I think there's an enormous, actually, strong, good is that are innovative. Yeah, that actually is a differentiating factor. A lot of people on the advisory side, there's a lot of people on the fund side. There aren't all that many people up and look at the landscape. You both as a service. So that's what we're doing. Now, fortunate on the mandate so far, and some others that will be announced soon.
But with that,
trophy.
Really a recognition of all you've done for us.
Thank you very much. Thank you, sir. So I'm going to put a shameless plug in as I step down. A shameless plug for the next panel features four of my friends. We're going to talk about, I think, most interesting elements of. After you have your dessert and everything. I don't know, Peter, when we're starting, but I think it's at 1:30 sharp. So we'll see you in there. If I can say that. Part of my.